Roger Williams University is hosting a crisis management seminar on May 3rd at their Providence campus. Crises, whether a natural disaster, cyber attack, or financial instability, can have severe repercussions if not handled properly. This is where crisis management plays a pivotal role. Join Roger Williams MBA students and expert speakers to learn how to prepare for the unexpected. The program is totally free and open to the public. You can register online at rwu.edu/events/crisis-management-symposium. Support the Bartholomew Town Podcast by subscribing, rating, and reviewing on Apple Podcasts.
This is the Bartholomew Town Podcast.
Welcome in to another edition of the Bartholomew Town Podcast. I'm your host, Bill Bartholomew. On today's episode, a conversation with Rhode Island Attorney General Peter Nerona. Peter Nerona is only a few months into his first term as Rhode Island Attorney General, but has already introduced several key policy and procedural changes, spanning from drug-related penalties to opening the lines of communication between the public and the AG's office. Our conversation examined the General's proposed new drug policies, which would reclassify many simple possession charges from a felony to a misdemeanor, amongst other shifts that would further refocus addiction as a public health issue, while keeping the pedal down in combating large-scale drug dealers. We also discussed his new interactive outreach programs, in which his office is ostensibly setting up a pop-up shop throughout different regions of the state. And I asked the AG for his take on the buzzworthy and critical topic of Rhode Island obtaining an accurate count in the 2020 census. Enjoy new episodes of the Bartholomew Town Podcast every Tuesday and Friday. Listen on your favorite app, visit bartholomewtown.com or ripodcast.com. It's where you'll find the dozens of conversations I've had with Rhode Island influencers, like former Senator and Governor Lincoln Chafee. I guess he's out in Wyoming now, though. WPRI's Tim White, Secretary of State Nelly Gorbea, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, Arlene Violet, community organizer Kobe Dennis, NBC 10's RJ Heim. It's all right there for you at bartholomewtown.com. All right, quickly, a few events coming up. This Friday, April 12th, it's Elmwood Songwriters Club, live at our loft here in Providence, presented by B-Town and our good friends at Lagunitas Brewing Company. Six Rhode Island singer-songwriters performing two songs apiece in an intimate setting, plus a guest speaker from the Rhode Island Politico universe. It's a great community hang and discussion. Elmwood Songwriters Club, this Friday, April 12th, 7:30 p.m., right here in Providence. For more info on that, follow the Bartholomew Town Podcast on Instagram at Bartholomew Town Podcast. And lastly, keep your ears peeled for more details about Bartholomew Town Live at PVD Fest coming up this June in downtown Providence. We're putting the final pieces in place. Can't wait to give you all the info on that. For now, visit pvdfest.com for complete festival info. All right, always a pleasure to have him on the program. This is his third overall appearance on the podcast, but his first as Attorney General. Without further ado, Rhode Island AG Peter Nerona.
You were kind of the de facto AG, pending AG, we'll say. I mean, you had to deal with Alan Gordon, of course, but so you had a unique pathway to get into the office. But now that you're there, what's that experience like?
Yeah, you know, it's almost like you turn the switch on January 1 and you step out of campaign or transition mode and into the job. And there's a huge difference in being a candidate, right? I deliberately did not have contact with people inside the office. I didn't think that was appropriate, put them in a weird position. I was a candidate. So you're seeing everything the way you would see it or your listeners would see it from distance. Once you're there, you now see everything. And so it's been great. Every day is a different challenge. There are some things that, you know, I want to pivot the office in some ways, and I'm sure we'll talk about those, maybe in a different direction, do things maybe a little differently. That's not to say that the way they were doing things in the past is not the right way. It's just the way I envision the office operating. So it's been great. All kinds of issues, criminal issues, regulatory issues, procedural issues, developing a relationship with the court, which I hope is strong, community outreach. So we're doing a lot. The days go by really fast. They're all fascinating.
Well, you know things are going well when they're zipping by like that, I suppose.
Sure. Yeah.
Let's start with the community outreach aspect of it. That's you have a facility in Cranston that your office is based in. I mean, that alone is a topic that is interesting, taking government into a place where you can park and access easier. Is that part of that community outreach process?
A little bit. I mean, I think it's sort of a metaphor for what I'm trying to do in this regard. So Attorney General Kilmartin, and I think this was inspired on his part, was to take those parts of the office that are public facing, so background checks, consumer protection, and diversion, and put them in a place where the public can access them easily, and to do it in a way which does not implicate taxpayer funds, because it was done through the Google case, which we did when I was U.S. attorney. So as a result of that case, the Attorney General's office and a bunch of other agencies got a significant amount of money. So no taxpayer funds, but make the office more accessible where it makes sense for it to be accessible. But my vision for the office outreach goes, I think, beyond that, and significantly so. So I want me and members of my team out in communities all the time. So for example, last week we were in Central Falls for 2 hours from 6 o'clock to 8 o'clock in the city council chambers, meeting with anybody who wanted to walk in. So we posted it, we advertised it, we worked with Central Falls leaders to make sure the community knew about it, and myself and our leadership team, consumer protection, elder affairs. We had lots of people who speak multiple languages there. And we had, you know, over those 2 hours, you know, I sat with the team. We all sat around a table. They would come in, present their issue. And if we could help them, we did. And if we couldn't, we would make sure that we had someone that could help them, and then we would follow up. And we're going to do that repeatedly going forward. We're going to Woonsocket, I believe, in May. We're going to Warwick in April. Basically, once a month, we're going to be in a community. We're coming to Providence on a more regular basis soon, where we'll have regular office hours here in Providence. The idea is that if you expect people to reach out to you at 150 South Main Street, which is where my office is, it's not going to happen. We've got to go to them if we want to help them. And I will tell you, other than there's a, you know, from a human perspective, being able to help people in a very direct way, and I can give you some examples of that, is incredibly rewarding, both for me and the team. I think we all walked out of there feeling really good about how we spent those few hours. But we're also building, I think, trust with the community, so that if we have to be in a situation where there's a breakdown in trust, for whatever reason, justified or otherwise, between law enforcement and the community, then our office we'll be in a position to hopefully broker some conversation and some understanding. And it's easier to do that if they know who you are before that difficult period arrives.
Yeah, absolutely. That would be a new role for the Attorney General, in a way, to kind of be a broker of between communities and law enforcement, or even just a connector. It doesn't necessarily have to have a negative context in any sense.
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right. I'm a big believer, and I thought this as U.S. attorney, in the concept of building relationships in good times. So if you have bad times, you can rely on them then. You may never need them, but along the way, you can do some good. So there are lots of things we can help people with. So we can help them with public nuisances. So if there's a particular property in a neighborhood that is not being maintained properly, it has become kind of a magnet for illegal conduct or dumping, trash dumping, we can do something about that. There was a person we were trying to help, and I think we will be able to help, who had never lived in Providence, had been billed for for taxes on that vehicle in Providence, and we were able to run a simple credit check for her, which indicated where she's lived for the last 15 years. She really didn't know how to do that, but our consumer person knew that right away and could do it right on her computer right there. So there are lots of ways that we can help people, but there's also this bigger thing, this bigger picture of, let's build that relationship with the community that we can rely on if we need to down the road. So lots of good reasons to do it. Help people, get the office out, build trust. I think it's all important.
Right. There's sort of a preventative medicine element to that as well. I don't know if you could quantify a number, but you could argue that someone who's able to button up their taxation issues will then save everybody money and hassle in the long run.
The reality is we can't represent individuals individually. That's not what we do. You know, we represent the people of the state, but we can help them get answers to their problems. And we can, when we see a pattern of misconduct, say in the consumer space. So one of the things I've asked our consumer people to do is, you know, periodically, you know, annually run who are the top entities that are complained about the most. So, you know, business A or entity A is being complained about once per year, there's not a pattern there necessarily. It may be an issue we have to deal with, but if the same wedding photographer has been complained about 10 times, well, then maybe that should go to the top of the list for us in terms of enforcement. So try to be strategic about it and try to help people in direct ways. And I think that's really good for the community. It's good for us. I'll give you one other example, and I love this. The first guy who walks in, comes in. He owns this piece of land, and he's got the great surveillance system. And he sees the people. It's nothing on it, but people are coming in and just dumping stuff on his land. So he's a pickup truck backs up, and all this landscaping debris just gets dumped on his property. He doesn't know what to do about it.
Wow.
And you know, we're lawyers, so we know how this works. And so myself and the criminal chief said, well, look, go down to the local hardware store or the big box store, wherever you go, get a no trespassing sign, stick it on your property. Now they know they can't come on it, and now you've got a trespassing. And that may drive people away, but if they do it anyway, now you got them on tape, you got a plate, now they've committed an offense, and we can do something about it. So these are not necessarily big fixes, but really important to that person. And again, you know, the word gets around that we care about the community. And we're there to help. And I think, you know, we're public servants. That's what we should be doing. Small things, but those small things add up and they build that trust that I think is really critically important to what we're doing.
I think it's fascinating as well, the statewide tour, if you will. You know, you're really going out into the community. It reminds me of the Lieutenant Governor's 39 yeah. towns and cities right. approach. Right. You know, right. just go there, find out the building blocks of that community
yeah, absolutely.
And understand it as best you can. Pivoting to specific policies, If we could, I was at a presser, I think it was a month ago now, where more or less there's a reclassification of or sentencing guidelines would change for certain drug possessions.
Yeah, right.
That speaks to, I think, changing times in a certain way. It's mm-hmm. it's not a hyper progressive position, right. you know, at this
Correct.
Point in time. It's more of a common sense position from my angle. But with the opioid crisis in particular and health, bringing in healthcare to the discussion. Is that kind of what drove your...
Yeah, yeah, really two things. I think you're right, Bill, that times have changed. When I was a youngish prosecutor back in the 90s, we were prosecuting people for possessing a needle and syringe. No drugs, just a needle and syringe. It was a 5-year felony back then. The legislature eventually changed that to their credit. We don't prosecute that case anymore. At the time, there was a lot of talk about, oh my God, this is, you know, it's going to encourage people, you know, to use more drugs. We were in an AIDS crisis at the time. That was one of the reasons for the change, you know, so that people could have access to clean needles, wouldn't reuse needles. At the end of the day, that was a good thing for public health, and it did not negatively impact on balance our substance abuse issue. It's a problem, but that was not a change that impacted that in any significant way. People go to jail on that charge. So times change. That's number one. Number two, I've been doing this for a very long time, over 20 years between being on the line and running an office, whether it be the U.S. Attorney's Office and now for the last few months, the AG's office. And I've seen the roadblocks to people that a felony conviction results in. So if you come out of the prison, or you never go to prison at all, but you are sentenced to a felony, that felony gets in the way of you getting back into society in a productive way. And when you don't get back into society in a productive way, meaning you can't get a job, you can't find housing, you can't get financial aid to go to college. In some instances, you can't volunteer in your child's school. You may not be able to coach. Look, in certain instances, all that's appropriate, but in many instances, it may not be or is not. And so to hang a felony conviction around a person who is possessing a small amount of narcotics of any drug for personal use, I don't believe is appropriate. I believe that should be a misdemeanor. That's the intent of the bill. Now, that does not mean the people who deliver drugs won't be prosecuted as felons. They will. It doesn't mean that people who possess drugs with the intent to deliver won't be prosecuted as dealers. They will. It doesn't mean that people who possess a large amount of drugs won't be prosecuted as dealers, because they are and they will be. I want to focus our law enforcement efforts on people who drive this drug crisis and emphasize for people who are addicts and simply possess small amounts, emphasize that this is a public health issue. Get them into treatment. Hopefully get them through treatment. And then when they're out on the other side, it's a lot easier without that felony conviction to stay on the path to complete recovery and function again as part of our society in a useful way. To me, it's a win-win. It's focusing our efforts where they need to be. It's giving people who are addicts but can get on the road to recovery the best chance of staying on that road. And to me, it makes a lot of sense as the world changes, as you indicated a few minutes ago.
And then it allows for, you know, DUI and trying to look at the major problems that are drug and alcohol related, on, you know, to separate the health aspect of that from the act of making the bad decision to drive high or drunk.
Correct. And those are serious things, right? We're all really concerned about those things. But at the same time, driving drunk, absent injury, which is horrendous when it happens, that's an appropriate place for a felony. You know, when it comes to narcotics, you know, if you possess narcotics for personal use, small amounts, I think that's misdemeanor conduct, not felonious conduct. And the implication should be that it's misdemeanor conduct, not felonious conduct.
Really interesting. Where do you have discussions about these types of policies with other leaders on a regular basis within the state? And do you feel like your position here is being well received?
Yeah, you know, I think it depends. Certainly, my sense is, and I believe this pretty strongly, that in the treatment community, in the medical community, I'm married to an internist, a primary care physician, that they think that this is a smart concept. I think that in law enforcement, you probably get mixed reaction as we begin to talk about it. But I will say, in law enforcement, they understand, as I do, that the implication here is really, or the import here should be about treatment. Law enforcement has kind of been, in many ways, the criminal justice system has been saddled with this issue in terms of treatment. Like police chiefs, I believe, are frustrated when they see people in their community who they know need treatment, but it's not accessible to them and it's not affordable to them. And so they know that they need to do something other than just let the person walk out the door, but that something isn't always available. So they want to make sure, and I respect them as a group and individually, they want to make sure that this doesn't have a negative impact. And so we're working with the chiefs, to make sure that the way this bill eventually turns out, if it does pass, is in a way that makes sure that we address those concerns. So, they're our law enforcement partners, and we've been speaking with them at length about where we're going with this. I would say beyond that, sort of generally speaking, their feedback has been good. I think this is the right thing to do. I'm confident in that. And I think eventually we'll get to a place with the legislature's help and the governor's help where hopefully we'll be able to do something good here.
Yeah. To me, it seems like an intersection where conservatives would, the libertarian strain mm-hmm. of their ideological makeup would, you'd think you'd want to go with this. And then on more to the left, it's, it just seems like everyone can get behind something like this. It's a societal issue.
Well, I think that's right, Bill. And if you look at the other states that have done it, they don't kind of fall into sort of the, red states and blue states. Yeah. So, for example, Connecticut and Rhode Island have done this, or some others in this part of the country. But so have, as if my memory serves, Utah and Oklahoma, right? Mm-hmm. Not states that you would necessarily equate with, say, Rhode Island or Massachusetts, at the bluer end of the scale in terms of sort of the way they look at the world through maybe a more quote unquote liberal lens. So I think collectively, whether you're on this side of the spectrum or that, we're looking at this as a public health issue. And does our criminal justice approach line up with this problem as a public health issue? Again, we're not talking about dealers here. We're talking about people who are addicted to narcotics. And remember, people get addicted in ways that don't start with illicit drugs. I mean, we know from this opioid crisis that you could have knee surgery and get addicted to OxyContin, for example, if it's prescribed to you. And then when you can't get it any longer, they work on the brain the same way, and then you turn to heroin or other illicit drugs. So it's not – these are not – there's a perception. I don't hold it, but there are some who hold the view that people who do start or use illicit drugs are somehow not to overstate, but bad people. But, yeah. First of all, I don't believe that personally, but also people don't always start by going out trying to bag a heroin. They get addicted to something that's prescribed to them, and then the heroin is the way to deal with that addiction when they can no longer get the prescribed medication. There is that connection which complicates this, and that's why we have to focus on this issue, not just on the illicit drug side, but on the prescription drug side as well.
Right. I guess that would be the next question. We have the Google settlement, which we discussed at the top of mm-hmm. of this episode. But with respect to legalized or legal opioids, I suppose, out there, this seems like there's a public awakening. We've seen some public art protests.
Yeah.
There's just more and more discussion, more mm-hmm. and more litigation that's coming out almost every week, it seems.
Sure.
But in terms of Rhode Island right now, addressing the opioid crisis from mm-hmm. the manufacturer's side of it, what's going on there?
Yeah, so we have a lawsuit pending, and because it's pending, I can't get into a lot of the details about it. But we, like many other states, we have filed on behalf of the state of Rhode Island. My predecessor, Attorney General Kim Martin, has, and we've continued with that lawsuit, a case against manufacturers and distributors, and that case is pending. There are many other suits like that around the country to hold and the allegations would hold those entities responsible for their role in this crisis. So that's part of it. And part of it is changing. And I think we've done a good job of that in the state, is changing the way we prescribe, both in terms of educating prescribers, physicians like my wife, like nurse practitioners and others who prescribe, about safe prescribing practices. So not prescribing too much, prescribing only when necessary, understanding more in the way understanding from the information we have today that we didn't have 10, 15 years ago, the impact of these powerful narcotics on people when they're prescribed them. And so, and how we approach pain, right? There, and in fairness to prescribers, there was an expectation a decade ago or 15 years ago that we were all going to be pain-free. No matter our circumstances, no matter our age, and as somebody who's in his mid-50s now, you know, I don't feel quite as spry going down those stairs as I once did, right? And so there was this expectation that, you know, your doctors would, you know, you'd fill out a pain chart and you'd do happy faces, right? Or how, what's the scale, 1 to 10? And you were really supposed to be at zero. And so narcotics could make you at zero, but there was this corollary of effect of addiction. And so, you know, we've got to understand that at some points in our lives, we may not be totally pain-free. We've got to treat pain differently. We've got to prescribe differently. I mean, kids would come home with getting your wisdom teeth out with a boatload of Vicodin back in the day. Yeah. And so, you know, you've got to be more conscious of that. The legislature and the governor have done a great job in recent years of limiting dosages for first-time prescriptions. And so we're moving in the right direction. I think the big – what we would have made more progress, and we're making good progress, but we would have made more progress had not fentanyl entered this mix. And fentanyl is a synthetic drug imported from China to the Mexican cartels. And the Mexican cartels initially were distributing it because it's even cheaper than heroin as a heroin-fentanyl mix. In recent years, we've seen it as fentanyl alone. And fentanyl is the real killer in this. Heroin is a killer. Fentanyl is a really, really strong drug, much more powerful than heroin, a really dangerous drug. And that's what I think has prevented us from making more progress than we've had.
There's no question fentanyl is pure evil. And what is the name of the law? I just had a blank. I should know that off the top of my head. The law that a dealer can be prosecuted for murder.
Christen's law.
Christen's law, yes. That was enacted for the first time this year. Is that
yeah,
true?
Yeah, well, last – yes.
Last year, right.
Yeah, yes, exactly yep. right. Yeah. And you know, that's – you know, that, again, is trying to draw that balance between sort of users – and significant dealers. And so that's it's controversial at the time. We may have even spoke about it the last time I was here. I certainly addressed it when I was running for office. And so what my view on it was, that's a good tool to have in the toolbox. What that allows is that a person who is responsible for the delivery of the narcotic that kills someone to be prosecuted for that homicide. But it's a tool that I think has to be used carefully, right? Mm-hmm. And so under what circumstances? To me, it should be reserved for the significant drug dealer, meaning moving a lot of weight, you know, kilo weight, is in the business, making money, large amounts of money, knows what he's distributing or should know, doesn't care about the consequences, doesn't have a personal relationship with the victim. I think that's different from two people who are sharing drugs together. One buys a dose and gives it to the other. One administers a dose to the other, and the person passes away. To me, those are two totally different potential defendants. Mm-hmm. And so you wouldn't use that tool on both. You would use it in the former situation, but probably not on the latter. And so what I've asked the lawyers in the office to do as these cases come to us is to look at those situations through that lens. It's a useful tool, but has to be used responsibly by us.
Yeah, very situational, because that could become a dangerous precedent, I suppose, as well, to go into other aspects of law, you know.
Sure, right. We don't want to overcharge. You know, that is, you know, charging cases is more of an art than a science. It involves an individualized approach to every case, understanding who the defendant is and the circumstances of the offense. When you paint with a very broad brush, I think inevitably you do an injustice. And so one of the things we did in the Obama administration, the Justice Department, was to really think about what we were charging and why we were charging it. I think it's more work, frankly. You have to be more thoughtful about what you're doing. But I think that's the way you achieve justice in the end. And that's the approach I'm bringing to the AG's office. And people have been very responsive to that.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a new way of thinking about how to be creative with the law, but not in a way to, oh, I got you, you know, in a
Correct.
Way to get the societal justice that we're after, I suppose.
Yeah, so I'll give you an example. I was just actually talking to a Superior Court judge about this morning. So you could have a drug conspiracy, and that drug conspiracy could involve – and when you do a conspiracy, so it's a drug ring, and they're involved in a conspiracy to deliver cocaine. And a lot of what drives sentences, particularly in the federal court but also in state court, is the amount of drugs involved. So let's say there are 6 kilograms of drugs, which for your listeners is about, say, of heroin would be about the size of a large cereal box. Okay, packaged that way, you know, roughly. So that's a lot of drugs. And yet everybody in that conspiracy does not have the same role. There's the ringleader, the person at the head of the organization, going back eventually to the cartels. But let's say even if we're just in Rhode Island, you've got sort of the ringleader, sort of the head of the organization, insulated from what's going on at the street level. And then you have, then you kind of work your way down the chain. Well, in my view, not everybody in that organization should be treated the same way. The 18-year-old, 19-year-old kid who is a drug runner or answers the door when the package arrives needs to be held accountable, but not in the same way as the 35-year-old person who's got 3 drug convictions on their record and is doing this and making all the money, right? So you can charge all of them in a 6-kilo case, but should you? And my view is you shouldn't. You have to think about where the heaviest sentences should lie, because if you're putting a 20 or 30-year sentence on everybody in that ring, I don't believe that's justice. So you've got to think about how you charge that case to reach the right result for each person in that conspiracy. That's a lot more work than just tagging each 6 with the same exact charge. That's the kind of thinking I want our prosecutors to be doing in every single case.
Fascinating. That's really fascinating way to think of it. It's looking at it from both the not overcharging, that'll come back to bite you in the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And it's unjust.
Yeah, I just think that's our responsibility. Our responsibility is not to tag everybody with the longest possible sentence. Sentences are appropriate in some instances. People commit violent crime. Drug dealers in drug organizations like the one I just described are often violent criminals. Guns, we used to say guns are tools of the trade of the drug business.
Yeah.
But not everybody's the same. And so you have to be thoughtful about how we approach criminal justice to get it right. As I said, it's more work. It's more of a challenge. But that's really, I think, ultimately what our charge is, and we should do it that way.
With regards to this, there's a lot of chatter this week about the census next. We're less than a year away from that right now, and the funding that would come with that. Of course, there's the concern about losing a congressional seat. But just in general, one thing that strikes me is the immigration or the citizenship question on there on the census.
Right.
What's your position on your message to someone out there right now, just as a leader, not even as the AG?
Sure.
What's your message to someone out there who might be have some trepidation filling out the census because of their own personal status?
Sure. My answer is get counted. As a practical matter, under the census, whether that citizen's question there is there or not, right now it won't be because it's been enjoined, but whether that question there is there or not, the census under the Constitution is designed and directed to count everybody in the United States, everybody, whether you're a citizen, lawful permanent resident, or you're here and you're undocumented. Why? Because we have over 7 million undocumented people in the country. Mm-hmm. They're here. We've got to come up with a rational approach to address that issue. And that's really a federal government issue. But we've got to address it. But they're here. And to not count them ignores reality. It ignores the fact that those folks are here. They're working here. Many are paying taxes here. Many are driving here. They are using our highways. And so whether you think that's a good thing or a bad thing, okay, the reality is they're here. And so for purposes of the census, we need to be counted so that we in Rhode Island and in Connecticut or wherever anyone lives, that the percentage of federal resources that are coming to Rhode Island is appropriate for the people who are here. We can wish. I don't think about it this way. But even if you take the most extreme immigration position, that you think nobody should be here and be undocumented,
right,
that's not my view. Even if you take that view, the reality is they're here. So let's get them counted. Let's make sure we know who's living here so that as federal resources are allocated, Rhode Island is getting its share. Because everybody else is doing the same thing.
Right.
Right? Connecticut is going to take the money, okay? Delaware is going to take the money. California is going to take the money. Alabama is going to take the money. Everybody should get counted. There will be no consequences by filling out that form. It is not a means of identifying somebody. It's a means of making sure that everybody, me, you, and everyone else is counted. And I think we really need to be very clear about that message. And thanks for asking the question. It's important that people know that.
Yeah, I agree totally. And I've been trying to raise it the last week or so. It's just like you say. So the money is going to be distributed. If we stand to lose $3 billion here,
right.
From my perspective, boy, that would be terrible. We can't afford that in this state right now. Holy Moses!
Yeah, well, at the event last week, one of the points I tried to make was we talk about voting, right? And as someone who ran for office, I recognize the importance of voting. We want everybody to vote. We would encourage people to vote. I think at the end of the day, the general election last year, I don't want to get it wrong, but I don't think we were over 60%. I'm not sure we were over 50% in terms of who voted last year, right? So if you think about that, you know, we're encouraging people to vote. Every vote counts. But the reality is that while I wish everybody counted, it's, you know, it's you win. You can win by a one vote margin or a 5,000 vote margin, right? Census is different. Every vote really counts in the census. Every person counts, because if you're not counted, you don't count against the total, and the total is what matters, right? So it's like equating how many people voted as opposed to who got the most votes. So when it comes to the census, every single person does really count. It's not a margin of victory. It's how many people actually participated. And so I think people have to think of it that way. In a sense, it's as, if not more important than voting. So let's get out there and get counted.
Yeah, and make it an apolitical issue at this
Absolutely.
Point. I can't understand the rhetoric that I hear, mostly on the talk radio, you know, type waves. But, you know, that this should be used as a way to go after people who are undocumented. I mean, boy, that's...
Well, I think the point that's missed there is that even if you take that point of view, and again, I don't take it, but even if you take that point of view, the reality is that there are 7 million undocumented immigrants here in the United States. And to ignore that reality, when it comes to the census and the allocation of federal dollars, particularly when one state is ignoring it and another is not, does not make a lot of sense to me.
Last few minutes here, there's a lot of the court system, I'll say. It seems in Trumpian times, even at the state level now, the court has a new role. It seems that a lot of policy, a lot of decisions are coming through the court system. They always have. That's nothing new. But for whatever reason, anecdotally, it feels like there's a new emphasis on that.
Yeah.
Do you have – what's your relationship like with the various systems in the state, the various court systems in the state, and the ones you deal with, the ones you don't, essentially?
Yeah. So on the states, I really deal with them all. So I'm in regular contact with the judges in the Superior Court, the district court where the misdemeanors are heard, and, of course, family court as well, because we have the juvenile system, a little less so in the workers' compensation court, traffic tribunal, where we handle cases there too. But I mean, I think there's a broader issue there, Bill, which is sort of how are we as attorneys general working together in courthouses across the country, whether it's attorneys general when President Obama was president or now that President Trump is president. And so there's a lot of those cases. I mean, we keep track of them. And if I were to give you the list of cases that are out there, it would be more than 25. Just since I took office, new ones are coming in all the time.
Yep.
And so the way I try to deal with those cases is, you know, I get asked, will you join this case with other AGs? And I always try to look at it through the lens of how does this case directly impact the people of the state of Rhode Island? I'm not interested in suing the United States or the president simply because he's the president or it's this particular president, whether I agree with his policies or not, and many of which I don't agree with. I look at how is what the federal government is doing impacting Rhode Island. So when it comes to the environment, I'm very concerned about those cases. And there are lots of them, emission standards, whether it be from vehicles or appliances or power plants. I'm very concerned about those cases. Consumer issues, very concerned about those. But I try to analyze them individually. How do they impact the state of Rhode Island? And do we have a good legal basis? And it's really two things. So how it impacts Rhode Island drives two things. One is the practical. Is it impacting people of Rhode Island in their everyday lives? And then does that impact rise to a level where legally I can't get in the case? Because it's something called standing. I can't get in a case unless I have legal standing. Legal standing is driven by what's the impact. So I always go through that analysis, and I try to be careful about that. There can be a rush to join that I try to avoid. I try to step back, get with my folks, think about an issue, and think carefully about what it is that I'm doing. And then if I feel I need to get involved in litigation against the federal government, then I join. And if I feel like it's not necessarily appropriate in this instance, then I don't. But it is – you asked, I think, at the top, you know, how has it changed candidate to attorney general? I will say, having been in the office 20 years ago, I think that has changed a lot, that the amount of national litigation that attorneys general are involved in – has exploded. You know, I haven't spoken to Senator Whitehouse about this or to former Attorney General Lynch. Senator Whitehouse was the Attorney General when I was there.
Yep. Under Sundland, is that correct? Or not under Sundland.
He was the AG. He was the U.S. Attorney me, and then he became the AG. Yes. So in that sense, we followed similar paths. I haven't spoken to him about that issue, but I suspect if I were to ask him or you were to ask him, he would say there was much less of that than there is today.
Yeah. It certainly seems it. Again, anecdotal, but just from the outside looking in, it seems like the courts are moving in the checks and balances are there, of course, but it seems like there might be a re-emphasis on that branch.
Well, I think what happens is as Congress becomes, as the federal government, in a sense, becomes less functional and more paralyzed, attorneys general end up getting into the mix a little bit more.
What's on the agenda for the next you know, coming up, anything big coming up in Rhode Island that you're working on?
Yeah, you know, we want to get our legislative package through. We really want to focus on this Deceptive Trade Practices Act fix, which will make us allow us to do more work for consumers, our drug reclassification bill, a few other things, community outreach, focusing on the most significant cases in the office on the criminal side and on the civil side. We're a really good government defense firm. We represent the state really well when we're defending the state. We do some really strong, proactive work, suing on behalf of the state, really want to expand that and do more in that area. And consumers, we got to do more to help everyday consumers here.
Yeah, and that'll attract industries of the future as well. Once those protections are in place, it seems like that's a very appealing ecosystem to operate in.
Yeah, I think that's right. We want to let, to me, the job, when you go up to 50,000 feet, our role should be making the playing field level for everybody, business, consumer, labor, business, people who do things the right way on the criminal side and people who don't. So if you cheat the system, when we go after those people, we're making it level for the people who don't. Public corruption, same thing, right? If you're a public official and you're doing it the right way, if you're doing it the wrong way, when we take those people out, returning it back to that neutral space. Government should operate neutrally, right? Everyone should have the same opportunity. And I think that's fundamentally the goal of the office. One last thing for your listeners. For the first time, I think, or certainly in a long time, we are posting every job on RI Jobs. And so if they're interested in a position with the Rhode Island Attorney General's office, every job is posted, everyone is welcome to apply, and everyone will get a fair review of their application. So I wanted to pass that along because from time to time we're hiring, and I want to hire really good people.
Out there, I'm sure there's one or two people right now who are already looking for that on their scrolling through their phone.
Excellent.
As always, thank you for joining in on the Bartholomew Town podcast. Couldn't do it without you, the listeners. I'll be back on Friday with brand new content. You can find every episode 24/7 at BartholomewTown.com or wherever you like to get your podcasts. Until next time, I'm Bill Bartholomew. We'll talk soon.
At HealthSource RI for Employers, we provide access to health insurance to more than 1,100 local businesses and nonprofits, and 96% of them renew through us every year. Maybe it's our choice of 19 different health plans, our 10 years of customizing solutions, or our one local team of dedicated experts helping employers find quality health insurance. See how our numbers stack up for you. Learn more at HealthSourceRI.com/employers.